This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any breaking updates and stories as we cover them here for you on this show. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me at Tony B Pod on Twitter. Today, we're going to be talking about evidence, and evidence more so in a broader spectrum than just in a vacuum on a specific case, because we hear so often, okay, they have DNA evidence and it's been sent to the lab. And I think a lot of us have different visions of how that works, unless you are actually someone with experience who works in a crime lab or is very involved in the criminal justice system. And if you are, great, then this is not information that is going to be new to you. But for the other 99% of the population, I think there's some questions there, some information that could be filled in. And with that information, a better understanding could be had about cases where DNA evidence comes into play, like the cases we talk about here on this program. We're going to be talking with a woman who spent most of her life in a criminal evidence lab, looking at DNA, looking at fibers, looking at all different things, and then going into court, testifying on what she found and trying to explain it to juries. Carol Murren is her name. She's a forensic scientist. Carol, thank you for joining us today on the program. And I'm just going to start out with a very simple, basic question, which I'm sure most of us could probably answer, but let's just start at the very basics. How does a piece of evidence from a crime scene make it to the lab? And we'll go from there.
Well, the way evidence ends up in a crime lab is after a crime is committed and discovered, the police take evidence. They go in and collect anything they see that's worthwhile and many things that don't turn out to be, and send it or bring it to the crime lab. And the different forensic specialists work on their portions of the evidence.
What kind of information does one in the lab have about the information, or the pieces of evidence rather, that they're examining? Is there much, or is it completely, is that information completely separated, so there's no chance of bias or anything like that in information that's being analyzed?
Well, the person in the lab knows certainly whether it's a homicide or a rape or a robbery, mm-hmm. but they don't have details on exactly what's going on. They just know to compare the evidence to any controls found at the scene and see if things match, or controls found, you know, from the body, etc., and see if anything matches and report that to the police and or the prosecutor.
Now, we've heard different stories of timelines on what it takes to get results from a lab like this. I'm imagining, and correct me if I'm incorrect, does it depend on the type of evidence one is looking for, the type of DNA one may be examining for, as far as the timeline on what it takes to get those findings?
It does. If it's a homicide, you can get them fairly readily. And readily is amazing because it turns around so much faster than it did 10 and 15 years ago, because the procedures have advanced that much. You can get results much more quickly. If it's a lower level, like a robbery, it is going to take a while for it to come up. And, you know, sometimes they don't do it till right before court.
Is that based on not necessarily the technology or the actual scientific process that's being used, but more so because of the classification of the crime that's being evaluated?
Yes, it's based on the backlog.
Okay.
So the lesser priority cases wind up farther down the backlog. And so, that's why sometimes they don't get tested until shortly before court, not like, you know, days before, but a few weeks before, so that the case can be prepared.
So it's an order of importance type procedure. Does waiting on that, does essentially having fresher evidence play any role into what results you find versus something that may have been sitting there for longer periods of time?
No. If we're talking DNA or hairs or fibers or glass or drugs, nothing's going to change over time. And the analysis will be the same.
Walk us through the procedure in something like the case that we've been focusing on with Brian Koberger and the analysis that I'm sure was sent there. But initially, let's talk about the genealogical connection that was found by looking at, I believe it was a cup or something of that nature that was taken out of a garbage can of his father. And then it ended up being 99.9888% or something matched that this would have been the father of the individual whose DNA was found on the knife sheath. How does that process, like, technically actually work?
Garbage is, you can go through somebody's garbage once it's out of their backyard and on the curb, because it's considered, you know, anybody's evidence at that point. It's considered that it's been discarded. Mm-hmm. So that evidence can be taken from the garbage can or from wherever they took it and tested. And as far as determining somebody was a father or a mother, there's ratios in the evidence from the father and from the mother. Of course, the Holberger's DNA would have been 50% from each one. So they can determine if it's one of the parents.
And as far as determining if it's one of the parents, how is that matched? How is that comparison made?
Well, the DNA is tested, and all of the loci are compared, and if 50% of them match to the parent, then they can determine that he is a descendant of that person.
Is there any wiggle room in things like that? Or is this pretty much, when you have that sort of a match, that's definitely the match? Not speaking to innocence or guilt, as DNA could end up on anything, anywhere, technically. But in terms of the science of it and looking at the results, can that be disputed? Is there any room for arguing against anything of that nature?
There's really not. It would be such an incredible fluke if two people had the same DNA, mm-hmm. other than identical twins.
Okay.
That there's really no way to get around the fact.
Now, we talked a little bit earlier about the logistics in terms of time to get the evidence back. But let's say that there is no technical time window. If someone said to you, and you had access, in theory, to all of the equipment and technology needed to do that test, how long does that test actually take to get done, literally from a step-by-step standpoint?
I believe nowadays, now I'm not a DNA expert, that wasn't my area, but I believe nowadays they can do it within 24 hours.
So very quickly, it's not a long-term process.
No, it used to be weeks, but it's very quick now.
Why did it used to take so much longer? What was different in the scientific process?
Well, the way they used to do it with putting it on a plate and having it migrate, all of the different locations migrate up the plate, and then to prepare the plate and look at the plate, it just took much longer than the way they're doing it nowadays. Those procedures have changed. There's fewer areas they look at now, too, to prove that DNA came from a particular person.
With speed, does it also increase accuracy?
No, it wouldn't increase accuracy.
So essentially, the same results that would have taken several weeks in the past would be the same sort of results that they would get today, not a difference in accuracy, just a difference in speed between the two is what you're saying.
Correct.
Okay. When they are looking at evidence in this case, I know they have some touch DNA, from what I understand, on a knife sheath. There's also some, they believe, some hair follicles that have been identified from humans, possibly a dog as well. And then there's also something that came in, and it's just been described as reddish-brown stains. If we were to look at it and take a guess, one would say, well, that's blood, but obviously needs to be tested. Can you explain the difference at all to us in terms of how those sort of objects are tested in different ways, if they are, and what types of results could come from any of those, and the accuracy of what could be found from piece to piece, from touch DNA to a hair follicle to a blood stain?
Well, a hair follicle from a dog, for instance, is different in appearance than a hair follicle from a human. The hair, the shaft of the hair, looks very similar, but if the hair was pulled from the dog instead of falling out naturally, you can get DNA from that and identify it to a particular dog. In fact, I think they're doing a little of that now, even on naturally fallen hairs. What kind of other evidence did you say?
There was, what they're saying is touch DNA, basically a fingerprint or something that had pushed onto a knife sheath in this case specifically, where not necessarily blood or something of that nature, but enough where they could identify the print and DNA with that.
Yeah. If you touch something, DNA in your cells is transferred. And so that's why people have to wear gloves for fingerprints and DNA. And that DNA, it used to take a lot of material to get a DNA result, but the methods have changed so much that it takes a few cells. And if they can get a few cells off of the item, they can do a DNA match.
Is that DNA match just as strong as if there were a droplet of blood or a hair follicle?
I believe so.
So essentially, if one just touches an item, your DNA is then on it, essentially.
Yes.
When we're talking about the differences with all the different types of DNA matching and touching, and in a crime scene, as we had seen here in the Koberger case, from what we understand, a very large mess, and four different bodies, four different individuals that lost their lives. And wow. Then the idea that the possibility of the killer possibly having some of their DNA mixed in, whether it be the touch DNA on a knife sheath, or the possibility that maybe in the process of stabbing four people violently, some of their own blood may have been mixed in. What is that process like for an examiner to go through that massive amount of evidence, that massive amount of blood? Can one determine two different types of DNA if they were, say, mixed together in, I'm not trying to be gruesome here, but like a puddle of blood, if there's two different bloods that have been mixed together, can that be separated as two different types of DNA?
Of course they can, because the one that belongs to the body, you can take blood from the body to compare, and then you can take that DNA out of the combination and get the rest of the DNA. The rest of the DNA won't be 100%, because there might be a few locations where they have the same DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it'll still be enough to make a good match.
When authorities would send in the DNA and the evidence, when you have that sheer amount of blood, are they sending in literally everything that they can obtain within the crime scene to try and find a mixture or a match in those mixtures? Or did they just send over bits and pieces where they feel there likely would be a mix there? My concern would be just the sheer amount of information and the sheer amount of testing that would need to be done in a volume of material?
Well, I'm sure different police agencies sometimes handle it differently, but ideally samples would be taken from all of the individual stains for comparison. Because, for instance, if DNA were splattered around and, you know, some of the stains were just from one individual and some of the stains were from more than one, then you really need to look at all of them.
And is that logistically something that is possible when you have a large volume of DNA? Like when I envision this just as a lame person who has nothing to do in that world, and I'm trying to imagine how this goes, when you have liters, in fact, of blood, and I have no idea what was obtained here in this scene, do you go in the lab and go through those liters of blood and piece by piece? How is that essentially extracted to identify the differences, if there is two, types of DNA mixed within one pool of blood to the naked eye?
They don't take liters of blood from a crime scene. They generally take swabs.
Yeah.
And so there wouldn't be liters to analyze, but there could be 100 samples instead of 5.
Yeah.
There are different spots around the room or more than 100.
Is it luck of the draw, though, then, that swab would have caught the two? That's my concern is, what if the swabs, just caught the DNA of one individual, but this area over here, had it been swabbed, maybe there would have been more of a mixture had that area been specifically swabbed?
Well, in a large stain, they probably would take, we're talking a stain 2 feet across. Mm-hmm. They're probably going to take several samples from that stain for testing.
And then the hope is that in that area, if they're looking for a mixture of two different DNAs, that they would have it within that specific sample piece.
Yes, because they would move the swab around to get a good size sample onto the swab.
When DNA is tested, can it be tested again, or is it in some cases where we've heard there's only a little bit of DNA here left, so we have to make this count, especially on some older cases where DNA testing did not exist at that point in time, but it does now, so we have to make it count if we're going to take it to a lab and use it? Is there specifically an end date to it, or once you use it, it cannot be reviewed a second time?
Well, once you've used it, it can't be tested again. I have been, not for DNA, but for other types of analysis, I have actually been called into the crime lab while they test in order to watch for the defense and make sure that everything is done properly. I also, when I worked at the crime lab, had it go the other way, where a defense expert was called in and watched me do the testing. So it can be handled like that when there's a very tiny sample, but it takes so little. There wouldn't be many cases that there's not sufficient quantity for both sides to test independently.
Do there be enough to take a look at, and it wouldn't be? Is that because of the chemical process and things that are used to identify that it then voids the DNA afterwards?
Well, you use up the blood, mixing it up. And you've destroyed it as evidence once you start mixing it into the chemicals that are needed for the testing.
Let's talk about the fibers that were found in this case. Specifically, what has been identified in an affidavit was specifically about, I believe it was a bed, mattress, and I believe a pillow, something of that nature, which was a fibrous type material. Tell me about the difference in identifying, or what one would be looking for in a lab when that sort of material comes in to assist with prosecuting a case.
Well, a white pillowcase or sheet might be more difficult to get an identification on, because it's generally white cotton, and there's not that many differences in cotton except twist and a little bit of color, but they might be using the detergent that's used to wash the sheets in and the fabric softeners that is used, because they can be identified too. So all of that is used when testing fibers. If there's colored fibers or blankets and they're not all cotton even, then a lot more can be done.
Are you saying to match those sort of things up to a crime scene, if something had been taken from a scene, taking a look at the detergent and such that had been used, let's say, by the victims, versus if a piece was found in the perpetrator's home, matching it that way?
Yeah, that can be done. But what I was thinking more is the perpetrator getting a few fibers on his clothing and matching that back to the sheets and pillowcases, not necessarily taking a pillowcase home with them, although that's certainly a possibility.
Oh, so simply just taking a look at their clothing, what was rubbed off, almost, you know, what one would describe as, you know, lint or the fuzzballs or something that gets attached to you that one would brush off or get off with a sticky roller, those little things that then could be matched up back to the scene of where that individual may have been.
Right. In any contact, there is some transfer, whether it be DNA or blood or fibers. Fibers are so easy to transfer, people don't realize it.
It's so interesting because I think so many times we just jumped to DNA as the only piece of evidence, because we hear about it so frequently, that would be transferred from one scene to another. But you're saying in many cases, there's probably even more evidence, not necessarily the details of a DNA string, but more so pieces that could geographically put someone where they claim that they may not have been by those fibers and matching them up to the scene.
Right. And hairs as well. An average human loses about 100 hairs a day. So it's pretty easy to transfer hair evidence as well. And with hairs, there's the possibility of getting a DNA match.
So vice versa, even the hairs of a perpetrator in a crime scene and or the hairs of a victim that had somehow made it onto oneself who was at a scene that may claim that they had not been.
Right.
Carol Murren, thank you so much for taking the time today to sit down and educate us a little bit more in greater detail than many of us knew of how the process works, timetables, and such. Especially, it's been interesting to learn how things have evolved over the years as well. Carol Murren, forensic scientist here on the program. If you like the show, be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any breaking updates and discussions on the case as we have them. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. I'm Tony Bruschi. For all of us here and the True Crime Today family, thanks for listening.